There's an interview with Squadron Leader Bill Wixon, Bill Wixon, in Wootton Bassett on the 6th of October 1993, recorded by Rodney Giesler.
Can we start again? Sorry.
Certainly, right.
If I can start off, date of birth, please. Yeah.
Right, born 10th of November 1925.
And what was your background and how did you come to join the RAF?
Right, so I was about 14 at the outbreak of war and I was still at school. And I stayed at school till 16 and a half, nearly 17. And I was a member of the Air Training Corps and everybody of my age group just wanted to get into the war in some capacity or other. And I was a member of the Air Training Corps and was intending to join the Air Force as a flight engineer. And when I left school, I took a temporary job on a fruit farm. And of course, being a Sussex man, working on a fruit farm in Sussex, every morning and every afternoon, the waves of aircraft would go over. And I was working on a fruit farm on the borders of Kent and Sussex, and all the activity, outbound and inbound, was all aircraft. And of course, we were just itching for the day to join the services, waiting until we were 18.
This was what, about the Battle of Britain time?
Yes, yeah. And then in September 43, I enlisted and became a VR and just had to wait for my call-up papers for the Royal Air Force. And I mean, the Americans were well into it then, and we would watch the American fortresses coming back, low level, shot to pieces. I mean, there'd only be about 1,000 feet coming over the top of our hills where we were, making for their airfields well inland. And as a young lad, I mean, you don't see any danger looking up at things like that. You just feel excitement and just waiting to be part of it. Then I was called up in beginning of 44, and January, I think, 44, and went on my course as a flight engineer. Initially, aircrew reception centre at London, based at Viceroy Court on the edge of Regent Park, which I believe pre-war was a block of luxury flats, and they were all taken over by the Air Ministry as it was. And I started 3 weeks in the Air Force in London, amidst all the bombing terrors of London and being based opposite Regent's Park, being on duty outside Viceroy Court on sentry go with a rifle and a steel hat and a gas mask, and under strict instructions from the corporal of the guard, in no way was I to take shelter in the sentry box. I was to stand on duty, and of course, being a young sprog, you do everything that you're told. And I can remember trying to get my shoulders underneath my tin hat as the shrapnel from the AK-AK guns in Regent's Park was throwing everything up. And everything that goes up has got to come down, and you could hear the shrapnel tinkling on the road and on the driveways. And what I should have done was to have ducked into the sentry box, obviously, but you, as a young recruit, you've got to do what you're told, or you believe you've got to do what you've told.
Where was the corporal?
I guess the corporal was somewhere in the canteen or somewhere like that. But and the shrapnel would be falling around, tinkling on the road, and just waiting for your sort of 2 hour stint to finish and someone to take over. After a few weeks of that, then, and that was all sort of square bashing up and down the roads of London and inoculations and tests, night vision tests and education films, like VD films, you know, don't do this, don't do that. If you do this, this is what you've got to do for treatment. And most horrifying for a young lad, really, who was sort of country born and bred, to be told all about these things and to see the films, and people would actually pass out and faint watching these films. Eventually we left London and I went down to Newquay, down in Cornwall, and number 6, ITW 6, initial training wing for aircrew. And we had a course of square bashing again, and the initial stages of teaching one to become aircrew, like Morse lessons, navigation lessons, aircraft recognition, mathematics, all the initial things that you had to have as a requirement for aircrew. And after a couple of months of that, then away to Lock-In in Somerset, near Weston-super-Mare, where one actually went into a hangar workshops, and you were taught engines, propellers, airframes, all basic stuff of different types of aircraft.
You never wanted to be a pilot? You always wanted
No, always wanted to be a flight engineer, yeah. I had the qualifications educationally to be a pilot, but I wanted to be a flight engineer. I enjoyed as a kid tinkering around with mechanical things. I mean, in my youth, we didn't buy bicycles. We went round the local scrapyard and we would make up bicycles out of bits and bits, as we used to call them. And my little gang of friends, we all, in the air training corps, were doing the studying lessons for to become a flight engineer. And basic engines and stuff like that, ignition, carburation, supercharging. It's quite a complex business, really, starting from scratch. Anyway, Lock-In, we finished the basic training at Lock-In, and then went to St. Athan in Wales, outside of Barry, for the final finish of our training as a flight engineer. And there we had cockpits of different aircraft with all the instrumentation laid out, and lots of the instrumentation would correspond to movement of throttles and things like that, all wired up electrically. It was really, I suppose, the early simulator. The modern aircraft has super-duper simulators where they can simulate everything, to inverted flying, rolls, spins, enemy attacks, attacking, all sorts of visual situations. And these were the early simulators. And we were then at St. Athan, divided into different groups, and given basic training on Merlin engines and Hercules engines, Pratt and Whitney's. And then towards about halfway through that course, I suppose, we would be subdivided again as to who was likely to go on to Lancaster's or Halifax's or Fortress's. We had Fortress's, American Fortress's, with the Royal Air Force. Liberators, we had Liberators with the Air Force, all different aircraft, Stirlings, we had all different types of aircraft for which there was provision for a flight engineer. And I was doing my specialist training on the Hercules engine, which was going to gear me up for the Halifax. The Halifax model at that time was the radial engine, the Mark III Halifax with the radial engines, whereas the earlier Halifaxes had the inline engine. But I was trained for the radial engine, and come our big day of passing out examinations and what have you, and awarded our brevi, and I can remember the day when we were being allocated to different aircraft, actually allocated to the aircraft units. We all stood out on parade, and somebody read out a list. We need six flight engineers for Sunderland's, over here. And six people who wanted to go to Sunderland's run to that spot. And we need 20 for Fortresses and 20 run there. And someone will count them off. No, you're too late. Back you go. And then they come round to the Liberators and Lancasters and Halifaxes. And I finished up on Halifaxes. And I went there as an individual posted to a Halifax heavy conversion unit at Marston Moor in Yorkshire, just outside of York. And I was, along with others, surplus to requirements at the time. We were just waiting to be crewed up. And
were you a sergeant by then?
Yes, yes, sergeant. On award of the brevet, you were awarded sergeant's stripes. And so that we didn't get into any bad habits or to keep us employed, we were all allocated to fly as second flight engineer with other crews that were doing the course. And I was flying with a New Zealander skipper, a chap called Bill Steele, Flying Officer Steele, and his crew. And I didn't know only the basics of the Halifax, a bit of airframe and the engine, a bit of electrics, all very limited. I was now at this heavy conversion unit going to get all the specialist instruction and flying experience, and then before being posted off to an operational squadron. Bear in mind that in my flying, which was now starting, it was my first introduction to flying in the Air Force. It had all been classwork before. Whereas the crew that I would ultimately be joining, the skipper, the bomb aimer, the navigator and the wireless operator, they'd all been flying together at advanced flying units.
But they hadn't yet gone operational.
They hadn't gone operational, no. But they would fly as a crew on an advanced flying unit, an AFU, and they might have been flying Whitley's or Wellington's, twin engine stuff. And now they were coming to the heavy conversion unit for the four engine. But the crew that ultimately myself and the two gunners would join had already been flying for several months together, so they were sort of a knit little community. And in a way, we were outsiders, the two gunners and myself, now going to join them, and we were absolutely ignorant of anything that went on in the air. So you can understand the when you crewed up with the crew, they sort of look at you and think, well, I wonder what he's like, you know, is he going to see us through our hour of need and all the rest of it. These things go through your mind. Same thing would apply to an army platoon. If they suddenly get a couple of new arrivals arrive and they're going to be in a hot spot in a couple of days, they look at these two new arrivals and think, well, are they going to keep the end up or are they going to let us down? So anyway, I was flying with Bill Steele, a New Zealander, and his crew. And he had a mixed crew, New Zealanders and Air Force. And I was picking up a lot of information as I was going from the current flight engineer, who was just about 3 weeks ahead of me on training. So he knew a lot more about it than I did. While we were doing the various exercises, my first introduction to hazardous life in the Air Force suddenly appeared, where we did a crash landing at Carnaby, up in Emergency Airfield in York, outside of York, on the Yorkshire coast, Carnaby, near Bridlington. It was a great big emergency landing strip, and we had problems, and we had problems with the wheel that wouldn't come down, and we lost our hydraulics, and I think the bomb doors dropped open of their own accord. One wheel was up, one wheel down, and the tail wheel down, and we were getting pretty short of fuel, and we tried everything in the book to get this wheel down, mechanically and physically, by sort of throwing the airplane at the ground and pulling up and trying to get it to free fall. And he just wouldn't come. And so we did a one-wheel landing at Carnaby. And that was a bit frightening. We had the top hatches open, ready to run as soon as we came to rest. And we eventually came to rest. As we lost flying speed, the wing dropped and the wing dug in, and a couple of pirouettes across the grass, and then the next thing, we were all out the hatch running like rabbits, because we thought it might blow, you see. But it didn't, and we went back a bit sheepishly, and Bill Steele, the skipper, he went up to the mangled wing, and I'm in touch with him now, after all these years, and he recently said, I've still got that navigation light on my mantelpiece, he said, still encrusted with Yorkshire mud, all these years. Anyway, I'm sort of digressing now.
That's fine.
I was still waiting to be crewed up, and I was in the sergeant's mess one night with Bill Steele's NCO crew, non-commissioned crew, and we were having a few beers at the bar, and all of a sudden, Bill Steele, Flying Officer Steele, and another officer walked into the sergeant's mess bar, and in those days, officers used to walk in the sergeant's mess and have a few jugs with their crew anyway, but you could never reverse the situation by going into the officer's mess. And Bill Steele came in. He said, "Hi, Bill." I said, "Hello, sir." And he said, "Friend of mine," he said, "at the same level of the course that I'm on," he said, "has just lost his flight engineer. His flight engineer has gone sick with eye trouble. Eye trouble or ear trouble, I can't remember. But anyway, he was taken off flying." And he said, "My friend now is without a flight engineer. Looks like he's going to be recoursed. And we wanted to stick together, to go through to a squadron together. How do you feel about flying and taking over his flight engineer's job?" And this other skipper said, "If you fly with me," he said, "I won't need to be recoursed," he said, "and you've been doing the various exercises with Bill Steele, so you've got an idea of what we've done already, and we will carry on from there." I said,
so
yeah.
He would have to be recoursed because he'd be taking a brand new flight engineer untrained with him, I suppose.
Yeah. He'd have to be recoursed to pick up a brand new flight engineer and start from exercise one and go right the way through again. He didn't want to do that. Obviously, the itch was there to get onto an operational squadron. The drive was there to get going. On reflection, one wonders why that drive was there, but it was. Everybody wanted to go. And so I said, "Yeah, that's fine by me, sir." And he said, "Right, you know who I am, don't you?" So I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, come on, who am I?" And I said, the rest of the crew blokes started to grin, but I was on the spot. He said, "Well, come on, who am I?" And there was a few chuckles. And I said, you're Flying Officer Bastard." "Bastard be buggered," he said. "Bastard's my name," he said. "Don't ever call me Bastard."
And that was his real name, wasn't it?
Yeah, Flying Officer Bastard. And he was a South African. And he said, "If you're going to call me anything," he said, "Bastard," he said, "but you can call me George." I said, "Right, George." I said, "I'll be glad to join your crew." So then we rounded up the rest of his crew in the mess somewhere, and we all had a few jugs. And then within a couple of days, I was with Flying Officer Bastard and his crew, and I stuck with them. And when we left Heavy Conversion Unit at Marston Moor, we were posted to 10 Squadron, Melbourne, just about 10 miles southeast of York. And I'm pleased to say that 10 Squadron is still operational now over at Bryce Norton with the VC-10s. And it's nice to think that your squadron you started off with is still going. And of course, I'm a member of the 10 Squadron Association. And we go over every year to Bryce Norton to be hosted by the current 10 Squadron, which is very nice. All my old wartime mates and chaps of 10 Squadron who did their tour way before me, years before me, but they all go over to Bryce Norton, or those who want to attend. I mean, it's a great reunion. So we went to 10 Squadron, and I think I had a total of 32 hours flying experience then as a flight engineer. But of that 32 hours flying, something like about 15 of it was as a second engineer, where I actually wasn't physically doing anything, just watching. So, comparatively speaking, I was very low on flying hours. But anyway, I passed the course. Maybe in those days there was no... I can't recall examinations. You did all the exercises, and if they were successful, then off you went as a crew. I can't recall any written exams or oral exams. You just did the exercises, and you were assessed by your instructors, and if you were up to the mark, off you went. And if you didn't, I guess you'd be recoursed, or have to do different exercises again. Anyway, we went off to 10 Squadron. And my crew, with Flying Officer Bastard as the skipper, and the other crew, Bill Steele, as the New Zealand skipper, we two crews, we went everywhere together. We would go on ops together, and so that we got stand down together. So we'd all go into York, whooping it up. And they were our buddy crew, if you can understand what I mean. We stuck through thick and thin. And Bill Steele flew EEZ aircraft, 10 Squadron's identification letters were ZA. ZA stood for Melbourne, and was painted on the side of the fuselage. ZA was the Melbourne. And he flew Easy, and I was ZA, and I flew F for Freddy, or F for Fox, as some people called it. And we would go on ops together, and we'd get stand down together, and we'd have leave together, so that we always had each other as sort of comradeship. And I must say that the rest of the crews on the squadron, although you knew the odd, I would know more flight engineers, because in my section, I would meet up with other flight engineers, but I didn't know too many of them. Not like modern Air Force. I mean, I stayed on in the Air Force for 40 years, and the modern Air Force, for instance, when I was flying the Hastings and the Hercules, I knew every man on the squadron. But in a wartime squadron, I knew very, very few. I just knew my own crew and this other fellow crew, and the few flight engineers in the section, and one or two NAVs and NCO skippers.
You were all in the same mess, weren't you? The whole squadron was in the same mess, or not?
No, the NCOs were in the sergeant's mess, and the officers were in the officers' mess.
Yeah, but I mean the NCO crew members of the squadron were in the sergeant's
mess. Oh, yes, yeah, the whole squadron would be in the sergeant's mess. Yeah. But if you consider that... for instance, on a Monday, Monday evening, 16, 18 Halifaxes would get airborne to go to Essen. The remainder of the squadron would be at home. You might be in the sergeant's mess having a few jugs with just a few people there, while the rest of the squadron were on a raid.
So the whole squadron... sometimes never flew intact in the whole operation.
Oh, no.
They just plucked a few aircraft from each squadron.
Yes, yeah. We only had one squadron at Melbourne, That was 10 Squadron. Airfields overlapped in Yorkshire during the war. The airfields were so close together, their flying perimeter, that when you went up to do circuits and landings for practice, the circuits overlapped each other, and you had different stack heights. For instance, in my area, there was Melbourne 10 Squadron, there was 102 Squadron Pocklington, there was 76 Squadron Home on Spalding Moor, 78 Squadron Breton, two Free French squadrons at Elvington, only a matter of about 4 miles away. I can't recall their numbers, 3, 4, 5, 3, 4, 7, something like that. Free French. And the whole Vale of York was covered in airfields, and on a raid, there may be a dozen aircraft from 10 Squadron and half a dozen from Pocklington and so many from 78 and 76 and make up a wave. So what I'm getting back to is that if I'd be in the sergeant's mess having a couple of jugs with a couple of my crew members, I might see other people, but the majority of them would be off on a raid. Well, when they came back, they would be abed. And when they finished their sleep time, they'd be on stand down. They'd be off into York, whooping it up in York. So you didn't meet people like you do on a modern-day squadron. In a modern-day squadron, you sit in the crew room, play cards, train in the simulator, local flying, but you're coming and going in the crew room all the time, and it's, hi Bill, hi Bob, hi Tom. You know everybody. And plus the fact the modern Air Force does not crew up. When a trip comes in for argument's sake, Hong Kong, the pilot leader will stick up the captain and the co-pilot for that particular flight number, and then he would send the list of flights through to the navigation leader. He'd stick on the nav, then me, the engineer leader, I'd stick on the flight engineer, and so on. So you didn't crew up, you were flying with different people all the time, so this is how you got to know them. Whereas on a wartime squadron, crewed up, your whole life existed around your crew. And if one of your crew went sick, something simple, diarrhea, went sick, couldn't fly, you'd have, and if he was a gunner, you'd get a spare gunner flying with your crew. And that was a very dodgy subject. You think, God, you know, wish we had old Smithy with us tonight. What's this new bloke? Is he new? Of course, pride is not going to let you ask him how many trips he's done, what's his experience, but for all you know, he might be brand new. And it doesn't lead to a fully coordinated crew then, because you're uncertain of somebody in your crew. Anyway, that's by the by. That actually happened to us one time. Smithy, our mid-upper gunner, he went sick, and we had a new fella come in. And we didn't know until afterwards that he was on his second tour of operation, so he was switched on. Nobody says what their ability is, or personal pride wouldn't let them do that. He was probably thinking the same about us, thinking, bloody hell, this crew have only done about 10 or 12 trips, and here's me, done 30, and halfway through another 30, and, you know, what are they like? He probably was as wary of us as what we were of him.
What was the average age of your crew, approximately?
Well, I was the youngest at 19. There's the picture up there. The Halifax at the bottom. The main picture is a Yorkshire-based Halifax, and it's headed Before We Go. And underneath it says a Yorkshire-based Halifax and crew prior to operations. The photograph at the bottom that I've put in is actually of my aircraft, ZAF for Freddy. And that's my crew. The skipper was... I was 19. The skipper was about 25.
Les Bolton, the bomb aimer in New Zealand, who was the oldest man, I would think. He was about 28. And the mid-upper gunner, the same as me, 19. The nav, about 20. And the rear gunner, about 20. And the wireless operator, about 25, I suppose. So we had three officers and four NCOs. Very young crew. And every year we have a reunion